other hand, reading is an embodied experience. We read with neurology, with our eyes, with our bodies. We hold books or ebooks or whatever. And so you're always in a chair or a place, and the sun is a certain way, and the outdoors is a certain way, and our feelings, therefore, are a certain way, our calendars. Some people think that's the benefit of work. You get to share the gospel with secular folks. And of course, that's beautiful if you get to. But Rainer says here that even if you're not literally sharing the gospel, you're embodying it. You're living it. You're using God's common grace and tools that you've been gifted with to make the world a better place.
Hey, welcome back to the Upwards Podcast. My name is Daniel Johnson. I'm one of your hosts. And today I am with a fan favorite, Byron Borger from Hearts and Minds Bookstore. We love Byron. He's on this podcast a few times a year and shares incredible wisdom with us, incredible insights with us, and resources that we know that you want to get pen and paper out. If you're in the car listening to this, go back, look at the show notes, watch it on YouTube, all those things to find all these incredible resources. So Byron, I want to start off today's conversation a little bit about seasonal reading. You know, we here at Upper House and the Stephen Little Brown Foundation are transitioning into summer. Not everyone is yet, but we are in kind of the academic calendar here. And I think you have some really great wisdom around seasonal reading and how we interact with different texts in different times of the year. What wisdom would you have for us and for our community around that?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. And I have mixed feelings about that. On one hand, as we've talked about before, when Susan has interviewed me on the podcast here, we've talked about the liturgical calendar, the seasonal calendar of the church year. And I think that's real important that we focus a bit on our reflections there. I mean, just for instance, right before the week of Easter, during Holy Week, I was planning a really big event for some authors down here in central Pennsylvania where our bookstore is. I may even tell you about those books later. But I felt really awkward talking about books during Holy Week that weren't about Holy Week, you know?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I'm not going to promote this book until after Easter because we got to focus our customers on nothing but the cross and the promise of resurrection. So I think flowing with the church calendar is probably most important with Pentecost coming up in the spring and so forth. On the other hand, reading is an embodied experience. We read with neurology, with our eyes, with our bodies. We hold books or ebooks or whatever. And so you're always in a chair or a place, and the sun is a certain way, and the outdoors is a certain way, and our feelings, therefore, are a certain way, our calendars, whether you have trying to go to a baseball game, you know. And so I think there's something to be said about sort of being attentive to the seasons, to the geography and the sunshine and the glories of even sitting outside with a book, the reading and studying outdoors when the weather gets nice, which you can't do, at least up at Upper House, quite so well in the wintertime. If there's any listeners from the Southwest or something, maybe this doesn't mean as much to you. But those of us that have four seasons, man, you can't go outside and sit in the snow very easily and read. So yeah, I don't know if there's wisdom about that other than to be aware that reading is an embodied act and that we do it sitting somewhere with a certain slant of light. And so yeah, sure, you pick a certain kind of things that might tie into the liturgical and church calendar on one hand, and the actual geography of your place. So I think some people, because their professional lives, it isn't so much that it's summer, but they're academics, so their summer life might be a little different than their regular workaday lives during the school year. And so they want to read novels, or they want to read books about nature because they're out in creation. We're doing some hiking or some recreation, you know, kayaking or something. And so I'm going to have some books even to tell you about sort of attending to the outdoors that are particularly apropos during summer. I think also in the fall too, when the leaves are changing. So yeah, I think there's something to that.
Yeah. I want to ask you a question. I have seen recently just kind of a resurgence, kind of awakening of work in faith materials coming out. It seems like there's kind of been an onslaught of that. I think it's an interesting cultural moment that we're in, according to that. I mean, the economy has had some ups and downs over the last, you know, 6 weeks or so. You know, in academic circles at the university here, you know, there's a lot of people that are fearful for research dollars coming in, even like their, you know, academic approaches, or even the, you know, is my position going to be funded again for the next year? There's a lot of kind of interesting kind of fear maybe around kind of this moment for some folks. And just want to know what you've seen around kind of the, all of a sudden, all these materials coming out around work and faith. Not that it has gone dormant, and obviously there's a lot of great people that are doing great work in those areas, but it just seems like the trend line kind of in this season of new materials and authors releasing stuff to us.
Daniel, I'm glad you noticed that, because that has been a passion for our store as long as we've been around. Back in the 80s, there wasn't much on a Christian perspective on vocation and calling and serving God in what we used to call marketplace ministry. Not everyone is in a marketplace.
Yeah.
But the notion of work and serving God as salt and light in the field of careers and professions, and then thinking faithfully and developing practices about that, there just wasn't much. And we were advocates for that early on. And then a couple of years back, Tim Keller, for instance, got the bug, hired a woman named Catherine Alsdorf, and started the Redeemer in New York City, Redeemer Center for Faith and Work. And those have now blossomed. There's a fantastic place in Denver, all over the place. There's these sort of Gotham centers that are studying the relationship of faith and work. And those books that keep coming out, they do kind of come in seasons, but they keep coming, and we are grateful for that. But here's the thing. You're in higher education, and I know you minister to faculty and to others who are already in that, thinking Christianly about their career in the arts or the sciences and research or biology or what have you. But for undergrads, this time is full of anxiety, because they may or may not know where they're going to work come the next year. And with the economy being a little odd and the cutbacks in all kind of areas of research with the current political administration, who knows what's happening? So I think the typical anxiety that college students feel when they're leaving is just heightened that much more. We know that to be true. There's a lot of anxiety on college campuses. So I want to start off by telling you about a book by a wonderful, wonderful friend of mine, a woman named Erica Young Reitz. R-E-I-T-Z is her name. And she works at Penn State University and has developed a program there when she used to work for the CCO, the campus ministry called the Coalition for Christian Outreach. She worked for the CCO and worked explicitly with college seniors. She developed a program called Exit, which was analyzing the sort of needs students had when they were seniors to prepare them to transition well into the workaday world. Many Christians that are on campus, if they're graced to have a study center like you do, or fellowship groups like InterVarsity or CRU or CCO or the Lutheran fellowship groups or what have you, they're in sort of almost like a bubble of thoughtfulness, of Christians integrating faith and learning, of stimulating stuff around social concerns and so forth with idealistic young kingdom thinkers. They go off into the work world to get a job in Iowa or someplace in the middle of nowhere, and they may not have a church that's all that cool with the best contemporary Christian music and the great Christian scholars that they're used to. And so many Christians that are actually leaders on campus find themselves in a bit of a quandary when they go off and have to find a new church, and maybe have to develop some new friends, and have to develop a way of thinking Christianly about the work world where they didn't quite land the job that they had prepared for. So anyway, Erica, in doing that the senior year, has prepared students to transition well, and she wrote a book about that a couple of years back on InterVarsity Press, and it just came out this past winter in a new updated edition. It is called After College. The subtitle is Navigating Transitions, Relationships, and Faith. And she looks at these key areas of faith formation, of developing friendships and relationships, of jobs faithfulness, and thinking Christianly about work. It's a key part of the book. And navigating that movement from sort of the abstract thinking about that together with Christian students, like at your study center, and actually living it out in the middle of nowhere when you get a job somewhere, maybe where no one else has thought that well about that. You are now a leader in this conversation in your own town, because nobody else has come from this sort of place like the study center where you are at Upper House. And so it's really kind of interesting because they're both in a quandary, being sort of alone perhaps, but they also are now leaders because they know more about this topic maybe than anybody in their workplace or in their home church where they find themselves. So this book is about that navigating that transition, about the first year out being so hard. If you've ever had Erica on your podcast, you probably have, but if you haven't lately, you should again. She is such an articulate spokesperson, such a gracious person, and she has tons of interviews she's done with college seniors that she's stayed in touch with, and many of them report that it's a lot harder once they're out of college than they ever imagined. So that transition book, it's a gem. She's really good, and she's still working in consulting and helping college students make that transition into the workaday world. So that's a good start on this Center for Faith and Work kind of lingo as it relates to ordinary 22-year-olds, you know, in the work world for the first time. Now, here's another book I want to tell you, and it goes hand in hand with it. This is the more abstract, visionary stuff, because I put this together. You may know this book called Serious Dreams that I edited. As a bookseller down here at Hearts and Minds in Dallastown, Pennsylvania, we would often have customers come in and say, our church has a couple of college grads. We don't want to give them a high school book, of course, but we don't know what to give them as a gift. And I realized there wasn't a great little book for college seniors going off into the workaday world that are college grads. I was asked to do a commencement address once at a Christian college. It's called Geneva in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, historic old college. And I gave this rousing, you know, plea for students to take what they learned at this Christian institution and live it out in the workaday world to make a difference as sons and daughters of Issachar, as I said, from Chronicles 12, to sort of say three cheers for the stuff you've learned and three cheers for the way you're going to live it out in the workaday world. Even if it's hard, even if you have to suffer, you're going to do this for Jesus, and it's going to be great. Well, people wanted copies of that speech. I don't know why, but I didn't really have quite a copy. I had these notes. And then that same year, like a month later, a couple of weeks later, I listened online to a commencement address that an acquaintance of ours was giving at Calvin University, Calvin College at the time in Grand Rapids. And it was built around a Wendell Berry poem. And it was such a great address. And I thought, oh man, now that ought to get in print. And I got this idea to call up a handful of people that had done good college addresses, commencement addresses that were visionary about the faith and work connection, living your life into the workaday world. Not every commencement address does that, but I found a handful of people from John Perkins to Richard Mao to Nicholas Waltersdorf, a number of men and women, a really, really good one by Amy Sherman that was offered at Malone College in Akron, Steve Garber, who's an acquaintance with some of you up there. And we put these together with some study questions and some notes, some little graphics about acorns that grow into big trees. And then I asked Erica Young Wrights, whose book wasn't out yet, but I knew she was working on it. I said, Erica, we'd like you to do like a little epilogue. I know it isn't a college address, a commencement graduation speech, but we want you to like bring it all home and tie it up with some practical insight. I wrote a foreword about kind of making a difference in your life and the way these addresses are also visionary and breathy. But I said, you know what, maybe in a different tone, I felt the Lord was guiding me in this, that God said, write a different kind of introduction that isn't breathy and change the world, but more like start small, live local, find a church, get a friend or two, like it's okay, care for your parents, write a letter to your old college pals. And so I wrote this long foreword, and some people said they think that's the best part of the book, is this foreword I wrote, not so much the breathy, you can change the world by making a difference as a professional in your workaday career, but more just like starting small and tucking into a little town you find yourself in when you're out there looking for a job, or maybe you don't even have a job yet. So Serious Dreams, Bold Ideas for the Rest of Your Life that I edited and that I've got two chapters in, and then that Erica Young Wrights wrote the afterword, which is the material that sort of developed with After College. She thinks that after COVID and with the rise of Gen Z, there are some significant changes with students that are now graduating in 2025, unlike those maybe a couple of years back. So that's why she revised the book. But she still would say that this is her second favorite book to give out to people after her own Serious Dream. So it's kind of a 1-2 punch there with the idealistic visionary sermons about making a difference in the work world and her practical stuff about how you make that transition well.
Yeah, that's great.
If this is all new to you, some of you listening from wherever you're listening into the Upper House podcast. I'll just highlight a couple of real quick books if I could about this topic, since we're into it deep. Those are for college grads. There is a book called The Call by Oz Guinness. I think it's a classic. It is one of the books that helped catapult this conversation about serving God in the workaday world back when it came out 25, 30 years ago. We had Oz at our own church, and he lectured on these impeccably back in the day, before the book even came out. And then when the book came out a good number of years ago, the lecture notes that he gave at our church were the actual things that were in this book. Finding and Fulfilling God's Purpose for Your Life. There was a 20th anniversary edition that was expanded with some new chapters a couple of years ago. And this, The Call, is eloquent. The chapters are short. It's almost like a devotional for really intelligent folks. Some people might find it a bit daunting because there's a lot of content. But Oz is so eloquent and gracious. Of course, he's with the Guinness Beer family, raised in China, has lived all over the world, came to faith through Francis Schaeffer. And he is here looking at both your primary calling, which is to follow Jesus, and this secondary calling, which is to discern where you're going to serve in a career or an employment or an avocation in your own life. So that's a must read. Another one that I think is a must read on the heels of that then is a book that asks, how do you stick to that over the long haul of your life? It's called Visions of Vocation by our dear friend, and I know you know him well, Steve Garber, Common Grace for the Common Good. Steve has a couple of books, and this is the one that looks at this question of vocation and how we develop a passion for being called into the world and what that might look like over the long haul. Some of us are idealistic. His graduation speech in Serious Dreams, my own graduate speech in Serious Dreams, pretty breathy, pretty idealistic, pretty hopeful. We're going to get out there and change the world. He says, you know, it often doesn't happen. In a broken world, there's a lot of sorrow and we give up too quickly. And he says, you know, you got to learn to live proximately, is his word, like approximate. You can't make a difference in every area of life completely, but in a fallen world, we can make some gentle differences here and there. And we have to learn to live with that without giving up, without growing cynical, without growing jaded. So this is the sort of how you can fight the big battles in life over the long haul of your life with a deep and profound vision of vocation that's going to sustain you even when you're only getting part of the blessings of making a difference in certain areas. It may be an uphill battle for some of us, and that's okay. We live with beauty and goodness and experience common grace in all kinds of areas of life. And this is not just about integrating faith into the business world or your economic or your career area, but in your vocations of all citizenship and all kind of things. So that's a gem of a book. If you want to talk about work as such, then particularly faith and work, one of the classics has been a book called Why Work. It went out of print. It's now expanded and out in a new edition by Tom Nelson. Tom Nelson started Made to Flourish when he, as a pastor, realized that he was inviting all the architects and business people and educators and teachers and his church to mostly come and work for him, like do work in the church. Sunday school teachers that were educators could help do ministry with children and stuff, as well they should. But he said, you know, I never really talked once about how people could work as salt and light on Monday morning and connect how what they do on Sunday with what they do on Monday. There was a gap. And the gap was there because he wasn't leading people into a whole life discipleship. You know this well at Upper House, and your scholars and students understand this. But most ordinary people in ordinary churches have never really been called to that. And so he said, I had to repent for my professional irresponsibility in not equipping people to be servants of God in the workaday world. And so he wrote this book, and there's little sidebars throughout it of architects and business people and nurses and engineering folks and computer science people in his church that learned from him that they could serve God in their work world and how they do that, the extraordinary purpose of kind of ordinary work. Well, the book's been expanded and changed around a bit. It's brand new now, and it's called Why Your Work Matters, How God Uses Our Everyday Vocations to Transform Us, Our Neighbors, and the World, by Tom Nelson. So that's a real good one if you have not studied this topic at all. Of course, I mentioned Tim Keller's book, Every Good Endeavor, that Catherine Alsdorf worked with him. That's sort of one of the cream of the crop books, serious and hefty. Hey, a brand new one that came out just this year is called The Sacredness of Secular Work. It's by a guy named Jordan Rayner. The subtitle is Four Ways Your Job Matters for Eternity, Even If You're Not Sharing the Gospel. Some people think that's the benefit of work. You get to share the gospel with secular folks. And of course, that's beautiful if you get to. But Rayner says here that even if you're not literally sharing the gospel, you're embodying it. You're living it. You're using God's common grace and tools that you've been gifted with to make the world a better place, even in the supply chain or whatever. And so there's four ways. I'm going to be honest with you, Daniel. When I thought of this book, The Sacredness of Secular Work, I don't like even to call it secular. So I thought, why is he even using this sacred, secular, dualistic language in the beginning?
Yeah.
And then there's four ways. And I don't like books that have numbers like that, that are four simple ways. And so I didn't read this at first. I thought, oh, whatever. One more guy chiming in about the faith and work conversation. There's so many better books out there. Well, then somebody told me, somebody I really respect, told me they loved it, thought it was one of the best books they've read on this topic. And I thought, really? I dug it out. I read it. I could not put it down. It was so good that I went back and read an older book of his about the kingdom of God or something. And it was fantastic. So I'm a big Jordan Rayner now. Public apology to him for judging the book by its cover. It's a heck of a great book. Really wise, really thoughtful. It does admit that the Great Commission is part of the commission we have to share the gospel, but it's not the only commission. We're called to love God with all we've got. We're called to love our neighbors well. We're called to think and use the mind that he has given us. This is personally relevant. It's devotionally, it's biblically faithful. It really is a hoot of a book. It's fun. It's interesting. Lots of stories, lots of biblical stuff. He looks at this whole journey of the Bible from creation to the fall that messes everything up to the hope of redemption and the scope of God's work in the world. So I'm a fan. The Sacredness of Secular Work, Four Ways Your Job Matters for Eternity, and that's by Jordan Rayner. That's a recent one, and I'm glad that I read it. I think some of your people
will. Yeah, he's great. He's great.
Is he? Do you know some of his stuff?
Yeah, we had him during COVID. We had him for a virtual event, and his book on time management stuff.
Yeah,
it was so good. Yeah.
How did I miss this guy? He is so good, and he's energetic really too. I gather too,
yes.
Right?
Kind of fun. Yes, super energetic. Yeah, so engaging. Yeah, he's really great.
I like him a lot. They say he is a leading voice in the faith and work movement. And I thought, how come I never heard of him? But I just down here in Dallas town, I missed him. So I'm a fan now. Everybody should get out and read that book. Hey, you know what? If you don't want to read a book on this topic, but you want to like lead a group maybe at work or in your church through a conversation or a Bible study, summer is a good time to read some serious stuff because you might have a little more time in the summertime. But maybe you'd like to just kind of start a group or even read it now and think through what you're going to do in the fall. There is a Bible study guide called Go Forth. It was created by the Redeemer City to City movement that now is the umbrella group that runs their Center for Faith and Work in Manhattan. And this is called Go Forth, God's Purpose for Your Work. It's an 8-week Bible study by Redeemer City to City folks. And what's really cool is it's laid out pretty nicely. There's some graphic pictures on the inside, some cool super graphics. There's study questions. There's some ready-to-do stuff. Then there's a key Bible references they give you. They give you a response, almost like a little liturgical reading or prayerfulness that you can do at the end of the session. So it's ideal for small groups. I'm a big fan of this. They've done another book that's kind of like this that has QR codes in it where you get videos that pop up. That's another resource that the Redeemer people did about justice in the work world. Highly recommend that as well. But this Global Faith and Work Initiative, this is the basic one that guides you into what it means to think Christianly about the work world with others. Thoughtfully done to discuss and have a conversation. You can buy a bunch of these from us. Everybody could use them, read them together. I'm a fan of that as well. Good, handsome resource for a Bible study guide on this topic of faith in the work world. So, you know, college students going off into the world, now's the time to think about this stuff. My fear is that some people that haven't grappled with that well in college, they've heard it maybe, and they have a sense of holy and high calling into the work world. They know it's okay to be a butcher, or a baker, or a candlestick maker. They don't all have to go be missionaries. They get that. But they haven't really grappled with it. They're going to get a job. They're going to be super busy. They're going to be trying to get up the ladder a little bit in their career. And frankly, they're not going to have time to think about this stuff. And then a couple of years in, the corporate culture is going to shape their imagination, and the practices that they do day by day are going to so erode their Christian vision. But that by the time they get around to thinking about this seriously, a couple of years in, they've already sold out to the company model and to the work world practices and to the vision and assumptions that are brought to the table by their bosses and by their corporate culture or their factory culture or their engineering culture or the institutions of which they're a part. So I am begging folks to do it now before the time runs out, before you've already given up too much of your soul and your imagination and your intelligence. Think about it now, early on. So if you're a college graduate or a recent graduate, dig into this topic now while you still can.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's so important in that transition. You know, I think one of the interesting pieces about the college dynamic right now is that everything is tailored to the student, right? It's the student experience. The student gets to, you know, an 18-year-old gets to take a survey on a professor about how well they taught the class, right? And then other students get to decide whether they're going to, you know, take that class based on that. And, you know, we're relying a lot on people that don't have fully developed brains yet. I mean, there's a lot of things in the mix there that I think are really can be problematic if the discipleship isn't done right. And, you know, you see a huge drop off of students leaving faith, leaving the church, you know, after college. You know, they get to a place that they don't, you know, a job, they land a job in a place that they don't know. They don't know how to get connected with the right community. Then maybe they try to stay connected to their old community by like doing church online, which essentially wanes over time. And they just feel really alone and isolated. And then, you know, without community, it's easy to lack faith or even lose it.
Yep. And so if you're listening out there and you care about college students or you care about young adults or you care about those transitioning into a new location and a new career after college, get them one of these books. Read After College. Read Serious Dreams at least. Give them some vision and some hope and some skills to make that transition well, because everything Dan just said is so true. That's really, really the case.
The podcast notes for today's conversation include a link to view this episode on YouTube. Remember to follow or subscribe to stay updated with our latest episodes in your podcast app.
You know, we're talking about young adults and making a difference in the work world, or older people that want to think again about the fresh stuff like Jordan Rayner's book, The Full-Time Career of Serving God in the Workaday World. And also, there is a time and place for thinking about rest, for thinking about things other than the calling to work. Vocation and calling is underrated too often in our culture, in our Christian culture, but sometimes we almost overstate that as if our work is all we do. So I'll tell you what, let me just tell you about a couple of books with summertime, better weather in the air. Let me just tell you about a couple of things that might be fun to think about in that regard. Can I do that?
That'd be great.
I just adore this new book. It is so lovely. It is so nice. It's a handsome little paperback. If you're watching, if you're listening, you can't quite get this, but it's a handsome little paperback that is full of woodcuts. And the woodcuts are all of animals, creatures that the book describes. The artwork is done by a guy named Matthew Clark. The book is written by a guy named Matthew Dickerson. Matthew Dickerson is a Narnia scholar, a Tolkien scholar. He's also a computer professor at Middlebury College in Vermont. He's written books about fly fishing. He's a real nature lover, creation care person. And this book is called Birds in the Sky and Fish in the Sea. And it is both writing and a poem, a little bit of memoir where he's telling stories about visiting wetlands or coming face to face with crocodiles or cool birds. And then this artist that actually does the very creative pictures of different animals and creatures, birds in the sky and fish. It is really, really nice. This book is just lovely. Every chapter has a biblical piece and then kind of a story and the artwork that's scattered throughout it and then a poem. I couldn't say enough about this little book. It's published by Square Halo Books out of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, a little independent publisher. And Matthew is a gem of a guy, really solid. Birds in the Sky, Fish of the Sea, about how to just enjoy animals and creatures and nature and what that looks like in our world. The Lord God has set us in the midst of his glory. Psalm, as you know, you know, the psalm that says that the Lord speaks through nature, that creation speaks. It's funny. It says there are no words, but he speaks. Mm-hmm. And so you got to hear God's voice by looking well and discerning the goodness in nature. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's a great book about those sort of themes. There's another book that I really, really like that is one of the most eloquent and beautifully written books I have read. I've read it twice in the last 10 years. It's called Refugia Faith, Seeking Hidden Shelters, Ordinary Wonders, and the Healing of the Earth. It's by a literature professor at Calvin University up in Grand Rapids. Her name is Deborah Reenstra. And Deborah is a heck of a great writer, poetic and gracious and eloquent. It's glorious the way she does kind of nature writing, if you will, looking at the creation the way Annie Dillard might, or somebody like that, Barry Lopez. There's a lot of great nature writers out there. And she's writing about the creation, but she's also making a claim that in the midst of climate change and all the horrors of ecological degradation, we have to create pockets of safety, of refuge for habitats. And animals show us the way to do that. There are habitats that have glories in them, and we can kind of study how animals make their safe habitats. So this is how to become a healer in a damaged earth, and sort of how to inspire others to do the same. So I love this book. I think it's so well written. I can't say enough. It's written by Fortress, a glorious hardback. I'm glad it's a hardback because it's one of those kind of books that you just want to read and be outdoors when you read it. It's a gem of a book. I like it a lot. Now, if you're a nature lover, and some of us only do this by reading, you know, we don't really go out there and face the rugged terrain and the upward rivers and lakes that you have up there. But some people do. They go out backpacking and look at the hardest places. They climb the mountains. They do the whole nine yards. Have you ever heard of a guy named Belden Lane? Is that a name you know?
No.
Belden Lane is a kind of a reformed theologian writer, and he's written a book about ecology and the history of the environmental movement and the way religion did or didn't play a role in that. He wrote a book years ago about desert spirituality and mountain spirituality in the great Christian mystics. And what's fun about that book is he actually goes into the desert to write about it, and then he goes into the mountains and writes about that. So he's writing about the desert fathers while he's in the desert. That's a heck of a great book. But the one I want to tell you about for your summer readers here is a book called Backpacking with the Saints, Wilderness Hiking as a Spiritual Practice. What he does in each chapter is he takes a great spiritual classic, Teresa of Lisieux and her disillusionment, or Thomas Merton, for instance, or Martin Luther, for instance, or John Calvin, for instance, or Kierkegaard, or St. John of the Cross. He takes these great writings, puts it in his backpack, and goes to the kind of mountain that he, or desert or location that he thinks would most resonate with that particular kind of story. And so the series of memoirs of outdoor trips that he describes here are kind of in a sequence. The first part one is called The Power of Wilderness and the Reading of Dangerous Texts. The second part is The Pattern of Wilderness Spirituality, and he talks about leaving the trailhead, that sort of departure, and he reads Columbus of Iona and Teresa of Lisieux, Thomas Trehane during that period. And then in the second leg, it's the discipline, the actual practice of the wild, and that's where he looks at Kierkegaard, he looks at a mindfulness writer from Vietnam, a Buddhist in that section. And then he looks at the descent when the trail gets really rough. And that's when he looks at St. John of the Cross and Martin Luther and the cloud of unknowing even. And then the fourth leg is delight when you come home and you've enjoyed and brought back certain gifts, if you will, from your journey. And that's when he looks at Rumi. He looks at Gandhi, actually, and he looks at Thomas Merton. So anyway, it's not all Christian saints, although most of them are Christian mystics. And he looks at these folks, takes them along on the backpacking journey with him. Each one is some journey he took someplace in the world, and some of them are actually pretty dramatic. So if you like nature writing or you want to do it yourself, you can learn how to do it by reading these particular classics in these particular locations with this guy that's quite the outdoorsman and quite the mystic himself. Barbara Brown Daler says, the only problem with this remarkable book is that it cannot be read rightly from a comfortable chair. As Delvin Lane and the rest of the saints in these pages insist, what the soul most needs is not found in safe places, but in wild ones, where the dangers are real as the courage they call forth. So find a high rock, a far hill, or a patch of desert that scares you a little, and let this book persuade you that you're exactly where you need to be. Well, wow. I did not read it in any dangerous place. I'll admit, I maybe could have fallen off my chair or gotten a paper cut. I didn't face any dangers with this book, but man, the wildness and the wilderness that he writes about, and then the way he invites you to think about these Christian saints, it takes those mystical books and brings them into a more practical light, frankly. I had read St. John of the Cross before, didn't care for it that much. When I read this chapter and how he put it in conversation with that particular journey and that particular place, I thought, oh, I get it now. So that was kind of fun. It's a nice way to be introduced to some heavy, mystical, contemplative writing while actually walking around on God's good earth.
Yeah, yeah. Those fun are great stuff, recommendations. Huh? Yeah. Well, I think that, yeah, just the invitation to be in nature and to experience it in many different ways, whether that's with the Bible or with these great works that open our eyes just to the nature around us and urge us to, you know, maybe go outside to stretch ourselves a little bit, to be in nature, especially during the glorious months over the summer. So
now, one of the places where you can do that, where you can kind of combine the virtue of stewarding well and caring well for the particular place God has put us and learning a little of the science of that while you enjoy things, is by caring for watersheds, caring for rivers and streams. I have two very good friends, and I want to tell you about them. I just brought them here to do some presentations in central Pennsylvania, and it was spectacular. The woman that co-wrote the book is Gail Hefner, who has worked until recently retired from Calvin University. She's got a PhD in urban sociology, but what she actually did at Calvin is worked for the provost office, trying to leverage the resources and the social capital of the college for the sake of the community. So she did academic-based service learning and all kind of repartee and working with others in the institutions and Black churches, all kind of stuff. And Gail was sort of an activist in the community. And then the other co-author of this book I'm about to tell you about is David Warners, PhD in biology, studied at Sable and some other places. He's an ecology prof and an environmental science professor there at Calvin. And they came to hear about 15 years ago, almost 12, 13 years ago, that one of the most polluted streams in all of Michigan, certainly the worst stream in western Michigan, ran right through Grand Rapids, and it was called Plaster Creek. There's a reason it's named Plaster Creek. They eventually came to realize it was used to be called the Kenosha. The Indians call it Kenosha, I guess, Kenosha. And when white settlement people came in, found gypsum in the stream, and it became one of the largest mining locations for gypsum, which is turned into plaster. Became the largest plaster maker in the country and ruined the rivers. 13 wow. mines in the turn of the 19, into the 1900s, with utter disregard for the native wisdom and practice that kept that stream alive for thousands of years. And within 25, 30 years, it became so bad that you couldn't even touch the water. And to this day, in 2025, they advise children not to play in the water. They don't let people fish in it because it is so dangerously toxic. Well, Calvin University, Gail and Dave got their students doing research on this. So they would go out with big waders and start getting the pollution counts, the toxic water counts, the E. coli counts. They started studying where the river is worse, where what's coming down from upstreams, agricultural runoff from the farms upstream, from certain golf courses nearby in the middle class parts where the stream goes. And of course, it runs down into an urban, pretty poverty area in Grand Rapids, mostly where people of color live. So you have this piece of environmental racism, actually. They've researched this. They've started a group called Plaster Creek Stewards, and they've been trying to bring restoration and healing to that creek for 15 years. They just wrote a book about it this year. It's on Michigan State University Press. It's an academic peer-reviewed work called Reconciliation in a Michigan Watershed, Restoring Kenosha. And Restoring Kenosha with the Plaster Creek Stewards of Calvin University, a Christian college, mobilizing people in the community to learn about planting indigenous plants. I mean, I learned this in this book. When you plant indigenous plants, they tend to have longer roots and they tend to suck up the water and can become toxin rehabilitation agents.
Wow.
Just planting rain gardens and stuff that settle the rain down a bit, doing rain barrels, all kind of simple things, planting things that stop the erosion of the stream can really help keep the pollutants from overflowing. And then, of course, it goes into urban water streams where people's literal waste, sewage waste gets into the streams.
Yeah.
We have that problem in York. We certainly have that problem across the river over in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where the storm water and the sewer water systems get mixed together and you have all kind of really gross pollution in our area. Then that goes into the watershed that leads into the Chesapeake Bay. So even a little bit of square mileage where there's a little creek and a little watershed settles into, in Grand Rapids, of course, it goes into the Grand River, which goes into the Michigan Lakes. Mm-hmm. And so the watershed of the Great Lakes, which you know goes all the way down to the St. Lawrence Seaway. So you're talking about major pollution because of this little stream. And they've committed themselves to spend the rest of their lives mobilizing people, churches and mosques, ordinary folks, social service agencies, and certainly the Christian college students there at the college to care for this creek. And this book tells all about it. I'm thrilled to promote this sort of academic book on Michigan State University Press, although it is applicable for anyone, anywhere, because this is happening all over North America, where watersheds are being polluted because little creeks aren't taken care of, in part because of runoff from people's lawn pesticides and because of cows walking in the water where the farmers aren't being careful. Mm-hmm. I mean, all kinds of stuff.
Sure.
And they've been doing this now for decades, and they wrote the handbook on stream reconciliation. They like to talk about reconciliation because they think that planting some native grass and stuff is part of the struggle, but that you could clean up a creek, but if you haven't like affected the social power relationships between people groups, between people of color, between indigenous people, if you haven't reconciled people, reconciling nature isn't enough. So they want to move from preservation and ecological restoration to actually what they call reconciliation ecology. It's sort of a new model of an interdisciplinary way to approach environmental science. So there's a lot in that book. I'm very impressed.
Yeah. That's cool. That's really cool.
The same people that put that together, Dave Warners, the science prophet Calvin, edited a book that came out of Calvin College Press called Beyond Stewardship. And they have a whole bunch of people. Deborah Breenstra is one of them. Gail Hefner is one of them. Other people in here, Jamie Smith, others have chapters that suggest that stewardship is not an adequate phrase for the theology of creation care, that we are not mere outside managers that kind of run natural resources for our own purposes. That stewardship model is not ecological enough, and it doesn't resonate with the real meaning of Genesis 1 and 2. So we're more than stewards. They still call themselves Plaster Creek stewards, but they want to talk again about reconciliation and about oneness with the creation and finding new ways to describe this great virtue of creation care. This is edited by Dave Warners, and it's a collection of essays. It's one of my favorite books on creation care. We have hundreds in stock here. But if you're wanting to read some fun stuff about creation care and the theology of nature and enjoying creation, and these bigger ones that I mentioned aren't good for your summer reading, dip into the chapters here. You could read each chapter almost in one setting. It would make a great small group conversation over a picnic table this summer. Beyond Stewardship, we would love to sell you that. New Approaches to Creation Care, edited by Dave Warners and published by Calvin College Press up in Grand Rapids.
That's great. Well, Byron, do you have any other resources that you wanted to share with us?
Well, we're running out of time, I would suggest. I don't want to take over people's patience too long. But I'll tell you this. We could talk about novels. I'd love to talk about novels for summer reading. But I decided instead what I'd like to do is talk about memoirs. I love reading people's life stories because good memoirs are often as literary as novels. And some people's stories, man, you can't make this stuff up. It's almost as wild as novels. I've read memoirs where I thought, if a novelist wrote that story, you'd say, oh, that's implausible. But people's lives are just so very interesting. I'm going to name a couple of real quick memoirs. I won't tell you too much about them. But if you're that kind of person that likes just some good literary reading, I read a book a year ago on a politics of grievance. It's written by a New York Times political columnist, was a White House correspondent for a while, named Frank Bruni, B-R-U-N-I. Those that read the New York Times may know his work. Frank Bruni now teaches at Duke, actually, on political journalism. In that grievance book, where he was just wondering why everybody complains about so much, everybody wants to jump to being a victim so quick, he ruminated in one page about an earlier book he had written about the incident in his life a couple of years back when he lost his vision. One eye was okay, but the other one he went blind in, and they said you could lose your sight in your other one too, a neurological, weird, rare thing. Had to have some surgery, was involved in some experimental situations. Nothing worked. And he said he was really traumatized by that, as a person whose main career and his main joy in life was reading. To go blind was a heavy thing for him. And he just mentioned that in passing in this other book. And I thought, ooh, I got to read that. And it took me a while to get to it, but I just finished The Beauty of Dusk. It's not an overtly religious book, although he asks theological questions and even consults with ministers and priests because he's trying to figure this out. Why do some things bad happen to people? This is his question on a vision that's lost. And then the subtitle is on vision lost and found. But what he means by finding his vision is finding his ability to live without sight. He interviews all kinds of people who are visually impaired or have gone blind. He interviews people who have lost their hearing as well, and other have physical handicaps. It's almost like he couldn't help himself. He was drawn to people who had disabilities. And as he began to get in touch with his own brokenness about this question of losing his sight and the fear of that, he began to become a better listener. He said, I was a journalist. I thought I knew how to ask questions and listen well. He says, oh, I had no idea. And he learned the art of listening well to people and their pain. And he realized many, many people are almost like carrying, if they had signboards, they would say, I'm hurting in this way or that. I've suffered this loss. I'm fearful of that. I'm coping with a physical pain or a mental illness. He said, people have so many stories that you don't even know until you read between the lines by being a good listener. So this is both about listening to people's pain and about resilience. I think if this book on looking at the positive side of coping with disabilities was written by somebody else, I might not even like it. Daniel, I don't like these kind of books that say, oh, just be happy. Some Christian books are that way. God is with you. It's all okay. It was meant for his good. You know, you lost your legs, but don't worry about it because now you know God better. Mm-hmm. Oh, man. But because he's a realistic writer for the New York Times and he's honest about his pain, he's honest about his lack of faith, he's gay and he lost a relationship over this. I mean, just his journey, his relationship with his doctors, and then his openness to listen to other people, it blew me away. It was one of the most enjoyable books and positive books that I have read in a long, long time. So I read a lot of heavy stuff, but this The Beauty of Dusk by Frank Bruni is a gem. Well, that led me to another book that has also got this really sad component to it. It's about illness and cancer. I don't want to say any more, but there is some sad stuff in this book. But when I first learned about it, I thought it was going to be a positive, happy little read. And it really is. It's a wonderful book by a woman named Carol Wall, W-A-L-L. It is called Mr. Owita's Guide to Gardening. It was an Oprah book. It got a lot of fame a couple of years ago. I don't know how I missed it. But Carol Wall's husband ordered a book from me. He's a Christian, wrote a book from me. And he said, by the way, do you know my wife's book? And I'm emailing him back and forth. And I was like, no, I never heard of it. Found out that his wife died of cancer after the book was written. She saw the final proofs, passed away. He did the book tour for her. It was an Oprah bestseller, all this kind of stuff. He was going around to bookstores all over the country and saying things like, I know you expected my wife to show up, but she's died. I'm sorry. I'm doing the book signing now. Mm. And he went to bookstores all over the country. They made a documentary about him, in fact, being the not the author of the book, but the husband of the woman that wrote the book. Wow. But the point of the book is Carol Wall is a suburban woman. She's a school teacher. She doesn't care about lawn work. She doesn't like the garden. She doesn't particularly like flowers, in fact. But all her neighbors had really spiffy lawns, and she thought she really ought to do something about it. And she found this African guy that was doing some yard work. She hired him to come in and do yard work in her house. She's instructing him. She's got a book and telling him how to prune certain things. He's incredibly gracious. And Mr. Owita, she comes to find out, has a PhD in horticulture from one of the best schools in the world on this topic, which is the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. And he could never get a job. He's Nigerian. He's from Africa. He and his wife are bagging groceries at the store. Mm. She's a nurse. His wife's a nurse working in a nursing home. And they become friends, and he becomes her tutor on all things gardening, on nature, gets her to love flowers, understand how to plant things so that they bloom at different times. It is a gardening manual. It is a journey of two friends. They both have dear spouses, but they are friends. There's no romance going on whatsoever, but they have a lovely friendship, cross-cultural. They're both Roman Catholic, they find out. And it is about their journey and beginning to cope with some health issues that they both have to experience. Mr. Owito's Guide to Gardening, the subtitle is How I Learned the Unexpected Joy of a Green Thumb and an Open Heart. So that's a great memoir that I absolutely love. Let me just tell you about one more that is really just fascinating. I don't know much about this author, Kelsey Osgood. She wrote an earlier book, which was a memoir about anorexia. Be that as it may, this brand new book is called Godstruck, and it is the study of seven women. So it isn't exactly a memoir. It's sort of the biographies of seven women who each have religious conversions. Now, here's the thing. They don't all convert to Christ in the way we as evangelicals might expect. One or two of them are, in fact, evangelical born-again conversions. Others are conversion from evangelicalism, say, to Orthodoxy or Roman Catholicism. One woman becomes Amish, which is a sort of curious kind of conversion experience. One is to become a Catholic interested in a contemplative silent monastic experience. One becomes a Jewish, converts to Judaism. One becomes a Quaker, which is kind of a sort of Christian conversion, but to Quakerism, which is interesting. One becomes a Mormon. So these are not necessarily, one becomes Islamic. So these are not Christian conversions, although some of them are of different sorts, but they are all the psychology of what these women went through as they went through a religious crisis, a worldview crisis, and found a new kind of faith. Of course, I'm not going to advocate someone becoming a Mormon or a Muslim, but their stories were very tender. And why people would be drawn to a religious conversion, whether it's becoming Amish or becoming evangelical or becoming Catholic, they're just fascinating. So I really like this book. For any of us that are in the evangelistic business or the mentoring business, those of us that work with others that are just interested about what goes on in people's souls and how they narrate their lives, this book is just really, really fascinating about women and their journey to new faith. So that's sort of an interesting resource that might be fascinating for some.
That's great. Well, Byron, we covered a lot of different subjects, work and faith to summer reading to some memoirs. Thank you so much for bringing us these titles and your insights into them. It's so helpful for us as we're thinking about our summer reading lists and thinking about what's next, what we should be reading, how that's forming and shaping us both as people and as people of faith. And so we're incredibly grateful for your time with us.
Well, thank you, Daniel. It's an honor to be here. I respect you guys so much. I got six or seven I didn't get to on spiritual formation because this time of year is also a time when we're hunkering down a bit, we're resting, we're reading outside. Maybe it's a time to attend to your soul. So there's some books about spiritual formation and reading the Bible well, the inner life. If anybody wants to ever send me an email and say, what do you got on that topic or this topic? Yeah. I'd love to correspond. It would be fun to talk further. We'll have to do this again.
Yeah, absolutely. So all the titles that Byron talked about will be in the show notes here in the episode. So you can click those. And we encourage you to reach out to Byron at Hearts and Minds to order those books. We love supporting what we call local, which is a friend here, as a part of the Opera House and Stephen Laurel Brownrum Foundation community. So, Byron, thank you so much for being on the podcast with us today. Thank you for our audience, and we encourage you to go in peace.
Thank you for tuning into the Upwards podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. For more information about the S.L. Brown Foundation and Upper House, please visit slbf.org. Go in peace to be a light on our campuses, in our churches, and in our businesses so that all may flourish.